This is Larry Greer speaking on behalf of the Rossi Living Museum. I'm here with Newman Greer, and today is March the 6th, 2003. Now, just Newman, I'd like to ask you a few questions, and we'll start with when you were born.
I was born on September the 5th, 1921, in St. Martin's.
All right. And when did you first come to Fairvale? How old were you then?
Well, I first came to Fairvale when I was quite young. I'd be going to school. I used to spend a week or so of my summer vacation with my grandmother, who lived on the Vincent Road. And she was a Vincent, and she married a Marr. Isaac Marr was my grandfather. I was quite young when I first came, but during most all of my younger school days, I'd spend some time in Fairvale.
Okay, and how long have you lived in Fairvale?
I started to set up a permanent residence in Fairvale about after I was married, about 1948.
Been here ever since.
Right.
Okay. Can you tell us a bit about your family?
When I first married a girl named Jean Charlton, and we set up housekeeping in Fairvale. I have two sons, David and Larry. One of the worst times of my life was in the early 1960s when my wife was diagnosed with cancer, and after several treatments and operations, why she passed away in 1963. It was a difficult time. She was 33 years of age, and my boys were 14 and 9. We were very lucky to get a older lady to work for her. Wife was very ill, and she stayed on with us afterwards and when the boys were in school, and we batched it on weekends and into the summer.
Okay. Maybe we'll change the direction a little bit, and can you tell us where you might have shopped for groceries and clothing back in the earlier days when you were in Fairvale?
We shopped for groceries at Guilford Roberts' grocery store in Ganola Point. But I can remember way back earlier that Claire Vincent had a store on the Vincent Road, and even before that, Edgar Vincent had a store right on the corner of the Vincent Road and the Ganola Point Road. I can remember climbing up the wide steps to go in there to buy penny candy. It would take quite a while to pick out 5 cents worth of penny candy. When you go in, there was a sleigh bell, I believe it was, fastened up over the door, would hit it when it opened, and this would indicate to them that they had a customer.
This you say this store was right on the corner of the Vincent and Ganola Point Roads. Is there a house there today?
There's a house there today, yes. Jones lived there afterward. Then it was vacant for some time, and now I'm not sure who lives there, but the house has been completely remodeled and rebuilt, and it's a nice-looking house there again today.
the other two stores you mentioned, there was another one up the Vincent Road. It's no longer a store?
No, it was only in operation, I think, a short time, perhaps 2 or 3 years. There's still Claire, one of their sons, is still living in that house. But the third house, perhaps up on the left.
That would be David Vincent.
Yeah, David Vincent, right.
David worked for the post office for a while. I happened to know him then. And the store Guilford Roberts had in Yolo Point is still there?
Yes. It is still there. John White runs it at the present time. Before him was McKean. Before McKean was Guilford Roberts. And way back before Guilford, by Guilford's grandfather, I believe it was, in that store. And that goes back long before my time now.
So that's quite an old building that's
a real that's old there. Building, yes.
Okay. What about major changes you've witnessed since living here? What comes to mind that you would say would be a significant change in?
Well, when I first read, as I remember way back, it was a country place with a big farms, a farmhouse here and there, and down the river road and perhaps the shipyard road and Cameron Road, there were some summer places that people came out from St. John, came out and opened them up in the spring and went back to St. John in the fall. I don't know when it slowly started building up along in the 40s and 50s before it really got going. And there was a lot of building in the area in recent years.
So the population was pretty sparse back in the early days in Fairville.
Yes, it wasn't a very big place. In the winter it would be a very small population. In the summer there was quite a number of summer people.
Okay. We say it gives life to our community here. And do you have any fond memories of the river in the winter or in the summer?
Well, at one point a few years ago I had a small power boat and used to enjoy running around the river, around Long Island and up to Perry Point. I think I had that boat for 2 or 3 years. The boys were getting a little older and they had their own interests, so it was too hard to put it into the water alone, so I sold the boat.
And what about the wintertime? Did you ever venture across the ice?
I remember I'll tell a story back on Christmas morning, 1932. My step-grandfather died suddenly of a heart attack. And that winter, my mother, my sister, and I stayed with Grandma over winter, and I went to the Rossi Consolidated School. During that winter, I can remember some of the boys, the Roberts boys and the Dobbins and several of the other boys around. We used to be around together. I can remember my first fishing for smelt through the ice up at, I used to call it Roberts' Wharf, down back of the store. And the other thing was, I obtained a pair of skates, but over at St. Martin's, where the Bay of Fundy never froze over, and we didn't have a good place to skate handy except a little small pond or something like that. Anyway, the boys over here were all pretty good skaters, and so I went down to skate with them one day, and they took off for across the river to the island, and I managed to, I was a long way behind them, but I managed to get over there somehow, but on the way back, my ankles gave out. They were just turning in and turning out, and I'd go a short ways and have to sit down on the ice, and they were all the time skating circles around me, going over and coming back, and I finally get back to this side, and I was awful glad to get the skates off.
That was kind of the end of your skating experience on the river. Okay. Again, we'll switch gears a bit. At one time, there used to be a regular train in the area. Do you have any memories, or have you heard anything that you could tell us about that?
Well, I had a trip or two. I was quite young. That was the way to travel from St. Martin's to Fairvale in the early days. You would travel on the St. Martin's to Hampton Railway and then transfer at Hampton and get the train coming down from Sussex or Moncton. And at Fairvale, I can remember the little Fairvale station house. It was built up on a level with the tracks on the north side of the underpass and just to the left, and there was wide wooden steps going up to it. I have a picture of it with my father standing on the platform. I think it was before my mother and father were married that he came over by train to Fairvale to see her.
Now, you had mentioned one point about another train that ran, the jitney, I think was the term you used, and it was a train that ran back and forth to St. John, maybe.
In later years, I never used it myself, but there was a train, small train, which they called a jitney, which came down from Hampton. And I was working at the dry dock at the time, so I couldn't use it because it didn't go near enough to my work to be of any good to me. But I can remember when I would drive down the road going to work, I would see men coming from all directions heading for this little station house at Fairvale to catch the train to go into St. John, because they could walk uptown from the station very easily.
And what kind of a time frame are we talking about now with the jitney? Did it run into the 50s, or when's the last you can remember it running?
Well, good question. Good question. Well, at least it was, it was after 1953, still running.
So it did run into the 50s for a while?
I don't think much later.
Okay. Now, again, just to try to tie into that with transportation, there was a bus service that used to run from St. John out here as well, and even one that I can remember as a child, but did it kind of tie in and take up some of the slack maybe when the train wasn't available, or was there any tie into those, or what can you tell us maybe about the bus service?
I don't know when the bus service started, but I don't think it could have been going when they were catching the train, or if it was, but later, when the train went off, well, we had really good bus service. We had a bus about every hour back and forth to at least up the Canola Point Road. It may not have ran up the Old Hampton Road quite as often. It would take an odd trip up there. But it was good bus service. And a lot of people used it. I used it a few times, but again, I was working at the dry dock, so it was it didn't go handy to my work to use it very much. One story about that bus service that comes to mind. After I had built the house here at 291 Manola Point Road, I decided I would try and do some work out or fix up the yard and do some lawn work. And there was a guy pole right in front of where I built the house, with a guy wire going down, and it was an ugly looking thing. I think it was an old pole that was left over from before they rebuilt the line, and it was one that and changed it to the other side of the road. I'd contacted NB Power and also the telephone company. They each sent somebody out to look at it and went away. Eventually I got a couple of yards of topsoil and were ready to fix up my lawn, but this pole was right in my way. I guess in those days I was a little impatient. I remember when up one evening I took a pulp saw and I sawed the pole down, and I fixed up the topsoil and seeded my lawn and kept on going. But a day or two afterward, I was talking with an elderly lady, that Mrs. Gale, that lived across the road. And she said, I don't blame you for taking that old pole down out of there, but I'm afraid that we're going to lose our bus stop. Unfortunately, this was the pole that the yellow strip was painted on for our bus stop. She said, I know they'd like to have that bus stop up at the top of Francis Avenue. Couldn't you paint a band on this pole on this side of the road or something? And I said, yeah, I think I could do that. So I took a can of yellow paint and I painted the band on the pole I thought would look about right. It worked out okay. We didn't lose our bus stop.
Well, that's quite a story. That's good. That's nobody was the wiser that the pole was missing.
Well, I don't know. I didn't hear anything about it.
Well, that's good.
I wasn't working for the telephone company then, so I wasn't worrying.
I'll go back again, I guess, to the river for a minute. For years, there's been an ice roadway to Long Island in the winter, and it's still, I guess, there from time to time, but it used to be quite a significant means of transportation for people coming across the river. Any memories or anything that you can relate to with the...
Well, not really from Long Island to Fairville. Of course, there's always one down Renforth. It bushed across from, I think it ran across below the island. Well, back when I winter of 32-33, when I was going to Rossi School, Mort Breen still lived on the island, and he used to bring artists across to school on the ice. The only other incident I can think of about ice crossing was up at Gondola Point. There's a story to that. Somewhere in the early 50s, I did some wiring across on the peninsula. Up until that time, they had no electricity. They could have their oil lamps and lanterns. They could look across the river and see all the bright lights over in Fairville. But this time, the line was being run down this side of the peninsula. So I wired several houses over there. One of them was Dennis Sheldrick's. At that time, he had a small store. Long early in the next spring, Dennis went by my place and he stopped and he said, I wish you'd come over and have a look at my wiring. I think there's something wrong with it because my hydro bill has gone up tremendously last month from what it always was. So I, at this point in time though, the ferry channel was full of ice and the ferry wasn't running. But he said there's no problem there, there's no problem to cross just up above the ferry landing, it's all bushed out and it's all right there yet. He said, if you want, why, you can follow me over and I'll show you where the best place to get on the ice. So I picked up my next door neighbor, Lloyd Gilchrist, and we followed Dennis up. And he went up 100 yards or so above the ferry landing, and because it was breaking up and along the shore in some places. Anyway, we went across there, no problem. Kept about 100 yards above the bushed out path, which kind of curved up river in the middle. And found a place on the other side where it was a good place to get off the ice. Went down to his place. I checked out his wiring and the panel and so on. Said, I can't see anything wrong with your wiring. I began to get a clue. I said, well, bring me your bills till I have a look at them to see how much it went up. And sure enough, the meter man had made a mistake the month before and they got a very small bill, but he never noticed that. And but when the big bill came, then I'm making up for it the next month, why, he sure noticed it. Anyway, by this time it had gone dark and the fog had set in. So as we come out, we realized this, so we made our way back to where we had come off the river and got back on the ice all right, but oh boy, there was about a foot of water on top of the ice, so the tide had come up as well. So we kept going along as best we could there, kind of watching down below. We had to keep up fairly well above the line of trees because there were some deep and bad ruts just above them a ways. And anyway, we were going along there, looked more like a boat than a car. We were holding both doors open in case we had to, she started to go down and we had to abandon. Got about halfway across the river and the line of trees kind of curved away, and in the fog I lost sight of them. Didn't know where they were. So I didn't dare to go to the turn to the right down toward the trees, so I just cut her in a hard circle around to the left, hoping to pick up the line of trees as we come around and completed the circle. And we did. As soon as we saw the trees, well, we took off again, and we finally made it ashore on this side. But I said, that's the last time I'm crossing a river on the ice. And it was. I kept my word there.
Yeah, that would be an interesting evening, especially with the fog. I've heard a term, and I'll mention it to you and see if you have anything you can tell us about it. It's Armstrong's Crossing. That mean anything to you?
That was a name that my aunt, she was an elderly lady and has since passed away, but she lived in Farewell all her life, and she could go way back. And at one time, I used to ask her questions about it, and she told me that that is what Farewell was called down around the the underpass. Was called, before the station was built, it was called Armstrong's Crossing. I have never any, she said that those Armstrongs lived in a house just about where that little flagpole is in the park there now. I have never heard anyone else that ever mentioned Armstrong's Crossing.
Well, that'll be one we'll try some of our other residents and see if we can gather any more information on that. I'll ask about a few points of interest in Farewell, and maybe you can just give me some detail of what you might know about them. And we'll start with post offices in Farewell. I understand that there were some post offices, and you might have some information on that.
Well, way back when I first came over to Farewell, the one that I remember distinctly is one that right across from the top of Shipyard Road. Maggie Kathleen ran this post office. And I was up there several times, probably with my grandmother at first. The other post office, this was down at the corner of the River Road, near the underpass. And McLean store. I don't remember being in this post office. The National Archives of Canada records the Fairvale Post Office opening in 1908 with Margaret Kathleen as postmistress and closing in 1946. The Fairvale Station Office opened in 1925 with Postmaster W.L. McLean and closed in 1983. On the other side of the underpass, at back in that point in time, was mostly just farmland. They were big farms, and I don't suppose there were less than a dozen farmhouses on that part of Fairvale. I think they must have come to McLean's for the post office.
So that would be the part of Fairvale that we now refer to as the Clark Road and that general area?
Our big business district at the present time. There was not enough there to warrant a post office, as far as I can understand.
So that would also include the part of Fairvale that was up on the Hampton Road now we refer to.
Oh, yes.
So all that general area up in there.
Everything on the other side of the...
On the underpass.
Underpass.
Right.
Very little there. So where people go.
As history tells us, then we had two post offices in Fairvale. One was Fairvale Post Office, and the other was Fairvale Station. Is
yes.
that correct?
And Fairvale was spelt with two words, Fairvale, capital V. Strangely, but the Fairvale Station was one word.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's how people wrote it down today, I suppose. Another different point of interest, the Fairvale Editing Association. I'm told it's been around since 1919, but do you remember anything about the Editing Association?
Not in the early days, but I remember the old clubhouse, and I can remember when they held dances in the old one, when they built the new building. I believe they rented the old building. I believe Wink Stevens was renting that building when it burnt. I think he used it for a snowmobile sales and service.
And that was on the same basic location where the current building is on the River Road?
Yes, pretty well. It was back. It was back farther, closer to the back of it was fairly close to the ballpark road. The only thing else I can remember is in later years I can remember a couple of Fairvale fairs down in that area. My contribution to that was hooking up temporary lights to turn on in the evening for the midway.
Okay. Odie Marr had a garage up on the, I guess what's referred to as the Hampton Road area.
Yes.
Do you remember anything about his garage?
Well, I remember seeing it. I know it was there. I don't really know the time frame. It was in the 50s. He also had apartment buildings. And at one time, for two or three years, or a short time, he also had a television sales and service. All these buildings were in the same area, but across from Wilson's Grill.
Okay. Now, we mentioned earlier about the trains, and you told us a bit about the train station in Fairvale, but that's one of the areas that I wanted to discuss, and maybe we've already covered it all, but there was a train station right there in the north side of the overpass, underpass, maybe we refer to it as. You don't have any time frames that it may have been there. It certainly wasn't there during my era.
It was certainly there. It was there in 1920. I have a picture of it taken in 1920. It was there when I was working at the dry dock in the 1940s, so I'm not sure just when it disappeared, but I would say it was in the late 40s, probably.
Now, it's, as I remember, I've seen a picture, a copy of that picture you're talking of, and it seems to me that the word Fairvale in it is in two words, with the capital V, as you mentioned. But yet, what's interesting, or ironic maybe a little bit, is the post office, Fairvale Station, which was the post office that was within sight of this train station, was spelt with one word.
Yes, I don't know. The Fairvale on the station actually was all capital letters. And it could have been that they moved the veil part below it just to be able to get it on across the end of the station. But where I got the different spellings was from the National Archives of Canada records. That was the way they spelled them on their records.
Okay, no, just it was interesting. I had to think about that as we were talking here. But. Now, right in the same area, we had the old CNR underpass, and it used to be quite different from what we have there today, and maybe you could tell us what you remember of it.
Yeah, I remember it real well. It resembled the one quite a bit up at
Model Farm.
The road came along almost parallel with the railroad tracks, and you had to make a real sharp left turn to go in through the underpass, and then a sharp right turn just as you get through to come out again on the other side. And it was narrow. You could pass a couple of cars in there. In fact, one time I met a bus in there, and we managed to get by, but it was pretty close scraping. It wasn't very high. That was one of the problems, was the height. I know when I was building the house, the cement trucks coming out from St. John had to go around up Ritchie Lake because they couldn't get through the underpass. I think they had a couple of small ones that could, but the bigger ones couldn't get through. They didn't have enough height. It was a very dangerous spot, but I never heard of very many accidents. I guess everybody in the area knew of it, and there were checkerboard signs, and everybody kept well over to the right and got squared up before they went through it, and didn't seem to be too much problem. Although I think it was built for horse and carriage days.
It was replaced with the current underpass that's there today. And I'm thinking that was somewhere in the 70s, I think.
Yeah, I think it probably. I couldn't give a date, put a date on it.
I certainly do. As a young fellow, I remember that old underpass. It was rather interesting, and one of the areas, I guess, that we might try a little driver training when you learn to drive a car and make sure you can get through that underpass. Now, the way back at the beginning of Fairvale, there was some shipbuilding went on, and it was down at the bottom of the shipyard road, and they called it the Titus Shipyard. Do you remember, have you heard any stories that might relate to that?
It was long before my time. The only thing I can think of is, I read in a book on Long Island where it was mentioning the people that lived on Long Island and the surrounding areas, and it mentioned shipbuilding in Moss Glen. There was Wetmore and somebody else and a Titus. And I think it didn't give the year, but it sort of indicated a time frame which I haven't got in my mind now, when Titus moved his shipbuilding to this side of the river and became the Titus Shipbuilding at the end of the Shipyard Road. There certainly, as I remember, being down to the beach there at the end of the road many times, in my time, there was certainly no sign that there ever had been a shipbuilding. So nature takes over, takes things back pretty quickly.
So that shipyard, we're probably talking in the 1800s.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Mm. Although they tell me long up into the 1900s, probably the 1930s and maybe later, that the big boarding house was up at the corner of Shipyard Road and the Gondola Point Road. Right on the corner where
Bruce Curry
lives today. I don't really remember that big building, but I certainly must have seen it because I know I've been to the post office across the road many times way back then. And on the opposite side of the road, a large house was the Carter House. I don't know whether, I wouldn't be surprised if Titus might have been connected with that place earlier. The three houses on the right, I think there's only two there now, small houses. Well, they were built for shipbuilding workers, so they tell me.
The Carter House is the current home there on the corner that David Hoyt
lives there at the present time. And Mr. Carter was a member of Parliament, and when the road was paved from Rossi up through, it stopped at Shipyard Road.
So he might have had a little influence in that paving.
I think so, yes.
Not totally something we're not accustomed to in our political things. And the houses you were referring to that were a residence for the shipbuilders, they were two or three little homes that were right on the side of the road going down the Shipyard Road.
Right-hand side going down.
On the right-hand side, right. Okay. Well, we've pretty well covered a lot of the area. I might just ask you if you have anything you'd like to tell us a little bit about yourself. You mentioned that you worked a shipyard at one point and the telephone company.
Yes. I finished high school in St. Martin's, and at that point I would have liked to continued my education some more, but the finances weren't available. My father went and had a talk with the principal of the vocational school in St. John, and it was decided anyway that I should go to the city and try to get employment and go to vocational classes in the evening. Well, getting employment wasn't all that easy at that time. This was in 1939. Along with a friend of the family that knew the city, we pounded the pavement for a full week. I put in applications at every business that we could think of in the city. Finally, I can remember going into the office of Frank Fales and giving him my prepared statement that I was looking for employment. No, he says, that's the way to ask for a job. And he wrote something on a piece of paper, and he says, take this down to my foreman at the my warehouse down on St. David Street. And I did. This turned out to be a recycling plant for jute bags. Downstairs, the operation was cleaning, sorting, and baling. Upstairs was a printing press where the best jute bags and of a certain type were turned inside out and reprinted, mostly for St. John Milling Company and Maple Leaf Mills. The pay here was $8.10 a week. And I can remember getting by quite well on this. My board was $4 a week. And I bought lots of clothes up at Jack's Men's Shop on Charlotte Street. I even bought a car. I can remember selling my old bicycle for the down payment and $2 a week from then on. I bought this car at St. John Motors. The funny, interesting thing was that I had bought the car, but I didn't have a license to drive it, nor didn't know how to drive it. Anyway, I went down to the motor vehicle branch in that little hole-of-the-wall place on Princess Street and asked for if I could get a driver's license. So Ned Sowery shoved a piece of paper out to me, and he said, come back when you get this filled out and have it signed by a representative of a licensed garage indicating that you're a competent driver. Well, I walked out and walked up the street thinking, what do I do now? And it just come to me. Ward Brown from St. Martin's had just got a job greasing cars at Clark's on Jermaine Street. So I went over there, and Ward was down in the pit. I hollered down to him, do you want to sign this paper so I can get my driver's license? He said, sure. So that took care of that little problem. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention that when I was bargaining for this car, I said that I didn't like the color, which was green. The salesman said, well, that's no problem. I'll throw in a can of paint and a brush. So I went down the next evening, and in an hour or two, I had a blue car.
That would be impressive in today's standard.
Anyway, after I come back from the motor vehicle branch and had my license, and went back down to St. John Motors, and the salesman showed me how to start the car, and work the clutch, and shift the gears, and so on. Then he turned the car around and pointed it out of the lot and handed me the keys. So after several jackrabbit stops and starts and stalls, I got it out and got out on the Rossi Avenue 3 mile stretch. So I practiced out there. There was very little traffic at that time. Practiced for about half an hour starting and stopping the old car. And then I took off for St. Martin's.
Yep, that's the early days.
Yeah.
So you had gained employment at Frank Fales. Did you work there long?
No, that was my first job. The next year, all those applications that I put in began to pay off. My next job was at T. McAvity and Sons on Rossi Avenue. I was working there in the shipping department, which I didn't really interest me too much. So when I got a call from the town of New Brunswick Telephone Company, well, I changed jobs again. I worked in the telephone set repair shop for a few months, repairing mostly those big wooden boxes with the crank handle on the side of them. And then I moved up to the switch room, where all the mechanical equipment switched the calls automatically. This was a good place to work and a good crowd to work with. I liked this job, but the problem was, now I was working shift work. A month of day work and a month of 4 to 12, and then a month of 12 to 8. Well, this put a kink in my social life, so I I moved from there and went to the St. John Shipbuilding in Dry Dock, in the electrical shop. And I worked there for 15 years. There was some periodic layoffs in between. But in 1957, I went back with the New Brunswick Telephone Company again. And I retired in 1982 with 27 years service, by bridging the year and a half or 2 years that I had previously. I might add, back when, after my first wife died and the boys were young, after a while I met a red-headed girl named Lois McCorkle, and she was the assistant chief operator for the telephone company in St. John. In 1969, we married, and we've had a lot of happy years together since then. I think my sons must have inherited my ability to pick good women, because both my daughters-in-laws are lovely girls, and though I've never told them this, I love them very much. That brings me pretty well up to date.
There was a time, as I remember, as a young fella, used to roam around the countryside with you a bit, you were into repairing television sets.
This was when I went back. I was way back. My first job was $8.10 a week. I don't remember what I made at McAvity's. It wasn't much more. But after working with the telephone company for a while, my pay was way up to $10.50 a week. And what was the question again?
Well, we were talking about the repairing of television sets and you get into that.
Okay. Then when I went back with the Brunswick Telephone Company, the pay really wasn't as high as at the dry dock for a while. And to supplement my pay, that's when I started, 1957, I started repairing television sets in the evenings, moonlighting. I didn't do any advertising, but the word of mouth seemed to work pretty well. Before it wasn't long till I had more televisions to... I'd spend all evening running around fixing televisions. But then when my wife took sick, I had to give up that practice up.
Where did you find your ability to fix televisions? Something that came naturally to you?
That's a good question. Most of it I picked it up on my own. First television I remember looking at. Well, I did work on radios. I did some experience working on radios before that, so I had. It was a quite a little jump to televisions, but the basics applied the same, I guess. The first television I can remember ever looking into was Mrs. Gale's across the road. She knew I worked on radio some, so She thought I should be able to fix her television. Well, I said, I'll have a look at it. And I guess I determined that there was a bad tube in it, and got a tube for it, and got it going. That got me started.
Now this is back somewhere in the 50s, I'm assuming here that you were...
Yes, it was 57. Probably 57, and maybe for a couple of years after that.
I guess the reason I can remember going with you the odd time, not very often, but once in a while I got to travel with you to go out, and we'd go into two or three or four homes, and you'd be fixing televisions, and it seemed to me like the last one that you went to, you decided it was time to bring that one home, and it was probably because I was with you, maybe, that it was time for me to get home, but you always brought the last television set of the evening home, and you'd repair it here at the house.
Yeah, there was quite a few of them that didn't just need a tube or something easy to fix, so I used to bring them back, and I had a television room upstairs, workbench and all that, and used to tear them down and put new picture tubes and whatever they required in them.
When did television come to Fairvale? Right about that time that you mentioned Mrs. Gale had a television set, so probably somewhere in the mid-50s, or?
Oh, there was, I think the television station went on the air, I think, sometime in the 1940s. But I didn't have a television until long after that. In the 1950s, before I had one. And it was an old one with about a 9-inch round picture tube.
I remember that television. It was a very light oak cabinet.
Yep.
The telephones, you mentioned that you worked, when you first went to the telephone company, you worked at repairing telephone sets. What can you remember about telephones in Fairvale in the early days? I mean, obviously there would have been maybe the wooden boxes in the walls, and then it went from that to a dial, or...
That's what it was. There were... it went to dial a very early 50s. I'd say 51, 52. But before that, some of them had the long boxes with a crank on the side. Others were, I guess the ones that they'd installed later were smaller, but they still had a square wooden box, but they did have a black plastic phone. There was still a handle, a crank handle on the wooden box. And the local telephone exchange was in Rossi, somewhere right at Rossi Corner. And of course the operators there placed all the calls and plugged them into wherever you want the call to go to.
And these would have been, was that the type of party lines, or did that come later?
Oh, there were party lines, yes. I know there was, there'd be quite a number on the line. I don't know just how many. I didn't know much about, didn't work at telephones at that time. But you could, if there were several parties on the line, well, each one had their ring. Like a ring might be two short and one long, or which would be 21, I guess. This was the way you turned the crank. You give it two short turns and a longer turn, and that's the way they distinguish who was supposed to pick up the receiver and answer the phone. But quite often, why, other people would know their ring also, and if they were a little nosy, they might go and lift the receiver and listen in.
That's not the privacy days. Now, when the dial phone came into existence in the Rossi or Fairvale area, telephone numbers at that point were Oxford.
It was Vinewood.
Okay, there. Yeah. I couldn't remember though. Okay, but it was fine. And how did that go? Well, that was something, I guess, that was pretty prominent all across New Brunswick.
Some important person in the telephone system somewhere in the States, I would imagine, came up with the idea that seven digits were just too many for people to remember. But they thought if the first two digits were letters, it would make it a lot easier. So they come up with a name, like VI was same as 8 and 4 on the telephone. So they called it Vinewood, and just 5 digits after that. That lasted for a while, but then they found that it used up their numbers, and it wasn't too long until they did away with that. Now we're dialing 13 and digits and more.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to have too much trouble.
It's gone from there. That's correct. Yeah. You probably remember the time when we changed from dial to a push button phone. I think we were, as I remember now, I think we might have been one of the first in the general area here to have a push button phone, and that may have been because you worked for the telephone company at the time.
Oh. No, I think as I remembered, I think we liked the old dial phone, and seemed to me we kept it quite a little while before we changed over to the keypad. It was I remember a nice chrome receiver on it, or the receiver, the hook on it for the receiver, and it would hook in there. When we first got some of the later phones, why, you'd go to hang it up and it would fall on the floor.
Now, we also had a unique phone system established with our next-door neighbors who didn't have a telephone at the time.
Oh, yeah, they were a couple of ship's telephones. They were called sound-powered telephones. They didn't require any batteries. All it required was just a couple of wires between the two phones. It was only good for a distance of, maybe 100 feet or so, but it was what they used all that time on ships. I don't know why for sure that they used that type of phone. I suppose it was because they didn't require batteries, and they were usually in great big steel watertight boxes, but they worked very well on the ships.
So we had a system similar to that set up between the two houses here, and if there was somebody wanted to call for the Gilchrists, they would call your telephone.
As well as having the two phones connected, I connected a couple of buzzers as well. And of course, they did require a couple of dry cell batteries. But I had a buzzer and a button in each house that we could push to buzz the other one to lift or take the telephone.
Yeah, I can remember that in my younger days. The telephone would ring, and then you'd go over and use this other telephone. It was in the other end of the kitchen.
Well, it was handy because they didn't have a telephone, and quite often we'd relay messages to them.
Yep, I can remember them coming running over to talk to somebody that had called them on our phone. Okay, well, maybe you could give us a little bit of idea of maybe what you do in your spare time as far as hobbies and whatnot go.
Well, when I seem to be very busy, but when I look back at yesterday, I know I can't think what I did. But, normally I enjoy gardening and yard work, bowling. Lois is busy in the church with a lot of different functions, and we go to reunions. And, I have spent some of my spare time, too, in genealogy. I've researched some of my ancestors, the Greers, the Mars, the Vincents, and the Wrights. And I have a book on each one that I have to refer to every once in a while when somebody asks me a question about the relatives.
Now, you're also a volunteer at the hospital, I believe.
Oh, well, that was another episode in my life. And on May the 31st, 1987, I gave up my tobacco habit. And I also admitted that I had symptoms of angina. So my cardiologist suggested that I go to Halifax and to the Queen Victoria General and have an angiogram. And he arranged this for August the 5th. So I went over, Lois and I went over, and had the angiogram. And the result was that I had three badly plugged arteries and that I required open heart surgery. They would put my, add my name to the list and give me notification when the date was assigned. So I come back home and I waited and I worried. And finally, I got word that December the 16th was the day. So the boys drove Lois and I over to Halifax and stayed till after I had the operation. And everything went fine, apparently, with the operation. I remember waking up in the
recovery?
Yeah, recovery room. And I'm taking the breathing tube out. Didn't seem long after that they brought me back to my room. A little while the surgeon came in. Surgeon was Dr. Landymore. And he said, "How do you feel?" Well, I was sort of groggy and kind of looked around and said, "Well, okay, I guess." Well, then he says, "You better get up and take a walk down the hall." Which I did after a little while with Lois's help. But two or three days after the operation, I had some problems. My heart stopped three times. But it did manage to start again on its own. Boy, what an awful stagnant feeling that was. After the third time, why, they took me to the operating room and put in a temporary pacemaker. This was a little box affair that attached to a wire which went into my groin and up through into my heart. And they said, don't double your knees up, legs up, because it might pull the wire out of your heart. So I woke up at that night several times with my knees under my chin, and I'd very slowly lower them back down and straighten out. Anyway, I think it was 2 days later, I was back in the operating room for the third time and received a permanent pacemaker, which is still functioning today after 15 years later.
So that led you into your volunteerism.
Oh yeah, after or as almost as soon as they, or shortly after they opened the heart surgery war unit in the St. John Regional Hospital, why emotional support group was organized with people who had had the open heart surgery, and the main function was to visit patients the day before they had their operation and visit them and check with them again the day before they went home. So I've been active in this volunteer work ever since it was started.
You You mentioned in the family the word Meyer and Vincent, and that you've done some genealogy. I think that both of those names relate back in the early history of Fairville.
Oh, yeah, they sure do. I think the Vincents and the Meyers, my grandmother was a Vincent, and my grandfather on my mother's side was a Meyer. And there was a number of Meyers living in the area, and they all owned large farms. In fact, I think they must have owned most of Fairville at one point, because there's still two roads named after them.
Now, if we did some research, we could probably find some land grants and some land sales that would have the Vincent and Meyer names probably attached to them. That would.
Oh yes, I have done some checking on that. They lived all the way from Damascus, and a couple of them lived on the Meyer Road. One I can remember had 320 acres, and others, most of them had over 200 acres of land. So there were quite a few Meyers in the area, and a lot of Vincents. There was a Vincent was a loyalist that got a land grant in Fairville. But the Meyers, they came from, I think the first Meyer came out to, what creek? Smith Creek. I think Smith Creek is where he settled.
Up the other side of Sussex.
Mm.
Right. Well, it's unfortunate the Meyers and Vincents didn't keep all that land for you. You'd be quite a valuable man today if you had that land today. Fairville certainly has grown.
Somebody would have to develop it.
Well, it pretty well ties up our interview, I think, today. I would ask you, is there anything else that you'd like to add to what we've done so far today?
There's probably things that will come to mind later on, but right now I can't. Nothing comes to mind.
Well, okay, with that, I certainly like to thank you for spending a part of your afternoon giving us a little history on your knowledge of Fairville. Thank you. Okay, we're continuing here with our interview with Newman Greer. There's a couple of subjects that have come up that we thought we'd like to elaborate on. The first one might be the winter that you spent over here in Fairville and went to school.
I think I was in grade 4 or 5, and that winter I went to school down at the Rossi Consolidated School, and we went back and forth to school in a sled hauled by a team of horses, which was driven by Robert Meyer. And coming from a little one-room schoolhouse in a small place outside St. Martin's called Bayview, to this big school where there was over 40 in one class, I was completely bewildered. And that winter I had a lot of stomach trouble. Severe pains in the stomach until the school night had gone by.
I can remember having a few of those myself, yeah. Around exam time, normally. we mentioned, or were talking here at one point a little bit about Francis Avenue, which is the street right next to your home here. And I guess you can remember back maybe in the early beginnings of Francis Avenue.
Yeah, I can remember it was back quite a ways. It would be in the 30s, I would guess, when I was going to school, that I can remember when I'd be over with my grandmother for a while in the summer vacation. I can remember that we're walking down across where Francis Avenue is, and the trees and bushes had all been cleared out, and it was like a plowed field. I presume it was probably plowed by a horse and team of horses and a single plow, no doubt. Then later, I can remember before anything more was done with it, it grew back up in bushes again, higher than your head. When Francis Avenue was first surveyed out, and it was only surveyed 50 feet wide, and of course the lots and the plan were drawn up in that manner. Later, when they wanted the government, they wanted it to become a government road, it was necessary for it to be 66 feet wide. This created a problem because at the lower end, Shipyard Road end, those lots were sold and houses built on them on both sides of the road. And up the upper end and on the point end, what was his name?
McGee?
Yeah, Dwight McGee. He built a big house there, almost bigger than the lot. But anyway, to overcome this, they were able to get enough land from the lower end, from the lot that Ernie Clark now owns. And at the upper end, why, they used some land off of lots that weren't sold from the other side of the road. And this widened the road to 66 feet, but it also changed the direction of the road somewhat and took some land away from some of the lots. But this wasn't documented very well in the Land Registration Office, and I think even today that some of the residents and the surveyors are still confused about Francis Avenue.
Well, we're on the subject. Where did the name Francis for Francis Avenue come from?
Oh, that's right. This land, when it was started to be developed, was owned by Mrs. Gale, that lived across the road from me, and her sister, Mrs. Turnbull, who lived in Montreal. One half of it, one side, was owned by Mrs. Gale, and the other half, the other side, by Mrs. Turnbull. What was the question?
The name Francis.
So Francis Avenue is often misspelled with an I instead of an E, but it was named after Mrs. Gale's daughter, Frances, who married a Haney, Frances Haney, and her name was spelled F-R-A-N-C-E-S. In late years, I looked in the phone book, and all the listings that were down Francis Avenue were all spelled with an I. I think the first phone book I noticed this, I called someone on the telephone company, got a girl, and so yes, she says, I can look after that. I gave her a list of all the telephone numbers. But the next phone book come, she hadn't done anything. I then wrote a letter, made it quite strong, and told them about the wrong spelling. Finally, I look in the phone book now, I see they're all spelled correctly.
So they did get it rectified. I know another person who used to be on that all the time was Mr. Searle. He used to live down towards the bottom of Francis Avenue, and I can remember him, letters to the editor and a variety of things, always trying to get the spelling of Francis.
I believe he
right?
got the road sign straightened out, spelling corrected in the road signs. Previous to this.
Just, I guess while I'm thinking, other things to talk about. Back when I was a child, at least, and I can remember the Vincent Road, which a little bit at the start of the Vincent Road is in Fairville, and then the rest would be in Goodall Point, but it used to be a dirt road for many, many years, as probably most of the roads were out here in Fairville. But at one point when I was young, at least, I can remember that it was hardly passable in the spring of the year.
Yeah, as I first remember coming over to my grandmother's, who lived on the Vincent Road, she was the fifth house on the right-hand side. And actually, in effect, that was as far as the road went. Because after that, there was just two ruts and a wagon trail on through. It wasn't passable with an automobile. For many years, the Vincent Road was a very narrow, wet, poorly ditched road. And who would have believed that it would turn into the highway that it is today?
Many houses and subdivisions off it now from the early days. And I guess when I was young, I can remember a little beyond where your grandmother lived. You would go as far as, I think the Snodgrass was the last house that really, and then it really got bad after that. And
yeah.
There were a few more homes a little further out in a little area there put together, but it was a pretty bad road back in my day too. So
Roberts is, who owned the Hillhurst Farm, which is a Hillhurst subdivision now. They used to drive their cattle out. They had bars on each side of the road just past my grandmother's a little bit, where the herd of cattle would cross the road and go to the pasture.
Oh, yes. Okay, so the pasture went out beyond the Vincent,
yeah,
across it.
They owned land on both sides.
Now, when you speak of the Robertses and the farm, the dairy farm, I guess they sold milk and so on through the area?
Yes, they were a dairy farm. They, I don't know what kind of cattle they kept, but they did, it was a dairy farm, and I can remember, or at least maybe I've only heard about it, that Eric Roberts used to drive a horse and a buggy of some kind and deliver milk. And then the story goes that one day the horse ran away on him and upset the milk wagon, and I don't know if he was allowed to drive anymore or not.
Now, Eric would have been the father to Ernie and David and some of the ones that you knew.
That's right, Phyllis,
younger.
Stuart, Ernie, David, Bobby. Their mother was a lovely lady. Her maiden name was Harrington. And up in the subdivision, there's a Harrington after her now.
Yes,
and she lived to be very old age. In fact, she outlived every one of her children, as well as her husband.